Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with an assessment of where the Russia inquiry into possible Russian collusion in Trump's election is heading and when there will be a definitive proof as the various strands of the broad array of continuing revelations are tied together. Jack Blum, a veteran Washington investigator who spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and served as the chair of the Expert Group on International Asset Recovery, who is currently the chair of the Tax Justice Network, joins us. We'll discuss the status of the various inquiries, in particular the special counsel's investigation, and the denial on the political left, as well as the lack of outrage on the right about the significance of a foreign power manipulating our elections, possibly to the point that voters will be demanding a do-over. Then we'll examine Trump's recent about-face in the Oval Office and the Chuck and Nancy romance that might save the DACA program, although there have been howls of betrayal from Trump's base and mixed signals in his tweets and statements about whether or not his wall will be built or be part of a deal to save the Dreamers. Sarah Binder, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a professor of political science at George Washington University, joins us to discuss whether Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell were secretly relieved that they did not have to face a showdown with their rebellious Tea Party caucuses threatening to shut down the government over the debt ceiling. Then finally, we'll look into another outbreak of unrest in St. Louis following the acquittal of a white police officer who was charged with first-degree murder for shooting a black man following a high-speed chase. Garrett Duncan, a professor of African American Studies at the University of Washington in St. Louis, joins us to discuss his article, How to Make Black Lives Matter, and how the shooting that took place not far from Ferguson, where Michael Brown was shot by police in 2014, was captured on dash cam video with the officer who was just acquitted saying, "I'm going to kill this expletive. Don't you know it?" Joining us now is Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who is an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and served as a chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery. Currently, he serves as a chair of the Tax Justice Network and the Violence Policy Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jack Blum. Well, thanks for joining us, Jack. And is there a way to do a sort of update, I mean, on this continuing investigation into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and perhaps the Trump family as well with the Russians? It seems that so many aspects of a broader mosaic are emerging as bits and pieces come out. At what point do you think there'll be a clear picture? Because I continue to get angry emails from American leftists who perhaps spend too much time watching RT, saying, "Where's the proof? Where's the proof?" And lots of emails that pretending to be Americans from Russians, calling me a tool of the CIA handlers and that kind of stuff. So at what point will we have, do you think, some kind of definitive proof that, not that it's obvious, but that this all happened and what really happened?
So the first thing to say about this is that in all complicated investigations where there are drip headlines, which is to say, a specific fact is thrown out, and there are a couple of news stories about it, it's very hard for people to follow the overall line of the investigation. You really need a timeline, and you need to put pieces together. For those of us who lived through Watergate, it wasn't until almost the end when we could see the full picture. You got headlines and other headlines, and to relate them to each other was very difficult. Now, in this case, there is an awful lot already on the table, which should be very clear to everybody about the fact that the Russians did interfere or attempt to interfere with the election. As people have said time and again, it's not clear whether any of this actually worked, but we do know they were sure working at it full time. And that was by planting disinformation, by doing a variety of things, possibly even spending money to advertise and put out stories that, in effect, would ensure the election of Donald Trump.
So the idea that a foreign power manipulated our elections, whether they were successful or not, seems to be beside the point, and we still don't know the full extent to which they did interfere. But what I find puzzling is that you have denial on the left and a lack of outrage on the right. You would think that people would, and by the way, James Comey in his testimony lamented about that. He said, "I don't understand why people aren't more outraged, and in particular, why the President of the United States has not even acknowledged that it happened, let alone called for ways to prevent it from happening in the future."
Well, the President of the United States has been very cozy with all manner of kleptocrats, and seems to like the idea that there are heads of state who loot the countries they are heading and take care of their families and friends first and foremost. And there's no better example of that than Russia. And to give you some very specific examples, Russia's largest corporation far and away is their gas company, Gazprom. If you were to go and try to investigate who owns Gazprom, you would run into a brick wall. At one point, the World Bank tried to find out whether they could make a loan to Gazprom, and they asked for the ownership information. They never made the loan because there was no way of finding out who, in fact, the owners were. The state was involved, but then there were individuals who were close to Putin. The entire Russian system is built on a supporting group of kleptocrats who are buddies of Vladimir Putin's. And the people who don't play, the kleptocrats who break ranks, wind up ostracized, unable to get back to Russia, and in some cases really deprived of their sources of income. So I think the most incredible example of that is Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who tried to run against Putin and found out what it cost him, which was years in jail. But to come back to the question of the failure to have any outrage, I think it's because it's almost too much for average people to absorb. But if you know a lot about history of involvement in elections and one government trying to overthrow another government by putting the people they want in power, we can look at the history of the U.S. involvement in any number of elections, beginning with the ouster of Arbenz, who was president of Guatemala in the 50s. We didn't like him because he didn't like United Fruit. And we used all manner of communications tools to rile the public up against him and get him out of power. And that was just the beginning of probably a 30-year period anyway of U.S. involvement in political campaigns around the world, either contributions to certain political parties through covert fronts or direct involvement in the election. One case that I know pretty well is the case of Chile, where we first started to make sure that Allende wouldn't get elected, and then made sure that he was out of office. He wound up dead in a military coup, and we wound up with one of the worst military dictatorships one can imagine that went on for a very considerable period of time. So this business of interfering in foreign elections and electoral processes is not new and not surprising. Now, why there's a lack of outrage is a question that even I ask from time to time, And I think it's because people assume that most voters are intelligent enough to disregard the kinds of things that get spread around in the course of an election campaign and basically won't go down the line with some outsider who's telling them how to vote. What has made this absolutely different is the social media effect and the ability to plant stories, let's say on Facebook, that get repeated tens of thousands of times, or also social media material that gets people to think their vote doesn't make any difference. And this has really changed the dynamic of outside interference in political campaigns.
And again, I'm speaking with Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who is an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and served as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery. And currently he serves as a chair of Tax Justice Network and the Violence Policy Center. So we know that Robert Mueller inquiry is looking into Facebook. Apparently they've received from Facebook through a court order these fake accounts, etc. What's your sense? You probably know a lot of the investigators. What's your sense of where he's, when we'll hear some final kind of...
The investigation that he's running will be clear at the point where various people are either indicted or not indicted for criminal activity. And I don't think you can expect anything other than criminal prosecution from that investigation. Who can be prosecuted and what they can be prosecuted for seems to be laying out as we watch this. One of the key issues on the table is, did all of these various people who were around Trump, who did business with and for the Russians, either in the public relations mode, such as Manafort, or in various business modes, such as Flynn, did they report this adequately, both on the forms they submitted for security clearance in the case of Flynn and in the case of Donald Trump Jr., did they, in effect, pay tax on the money that they received, which was not inconsiderable? Now, there's also, and this is obviously out there because of some of the people who've been brought on to the Mueller investigation, it seems that there is a look at the use of the sale of real estate and apartments as a way of laundering Russian money and placing it in the U.S., so that it can be put into use later on or put into action internationally as clean money. One of the favored ways of laundering money is to buy an asset in the U.S., principally real estate, where there are no records kept of who is doing the buying, or at least were none in most places in the United States until about a year ago. And a year ago, New York and Miami were the two places where you had to report who the beneficial owner was. But today, even today, I should say, property is being purchased by people who want to hide money in the U.S. and launder the proceeds of crime. And because of the existence of anonymous corporations, shell companies, offshore operations of one kind or another, it is terribly difficult to find out who's behind a particular purchase and what the meaning of the purchase is. Is it laundering? Is it not laundering? But the truth is that an awful lot of the money that's come into Trump properties has been from people connected to Russia or one or another of the former Russian republics.
Well, the president himself keeps meeting with these kleptocrats. He just met with the kleptocrat from Malaysia, who's, by the way, stayed in the Trump Hotel in along with his entourage. And, of course, the crew, the group in Washington looking into transparency, they have sued Trump to find out who have which lobbyists, etc., had visited Mar-a-Lago, and they got this contemptuous reply, which was a list of the staff and that attended Abe's visit down there early in the Trump administration. But obviously, they're just basically stiffing the judge who ordered this. So it's pretty clear from the kind of people that Trump is sympathetic to, that he meets with, like Erdogan, whose thugs beat up protesters in Washington, Duterte, the killer in the Philippines, etc. I mean, it's my sense is that Trump is pretty signaled pretty clearly that these are his kind of guys.
Well, the model that Trump seems to be following is a model that kleptocrats around the world have followed. They come to power, they bring their family into positions of power, or positions from which they can take advantage of the fact that they're related to the key man at the center of things. And they disregard the idea of conflict of interest. In Trump's case, it's been a public disavowal. He says there can't be a conflict of interest because, after all, the law doesn't apply to me. And then what he does is reach out to all of these kleptocrats from other countries, bring them here, and make Americans feel that this is the new normal, that what he's doing is, hey, I'm just behaving like another one of these guys, and why are you all upset? Because this is what people who head countries do.
So at what point, though, do you think that we'll get past this? I mean, it's a pretty sad that people feel so alienated from their own government that they don't believe anything that the government says, even though this is a government controlled by Trump. But in spite of that, we've learned that 17 of intelligence agencies of the alphabet soup there have all said that this is real, and it was ordered by Putin. Now, I'm hearing from Russian sources that there's some buyer's remorse going on in the Kremlin, and that those that warned Putin against this and against the blowback are in the ascendancy, whereas those that the young Turks and the old conservatives who went along with this manipulation of the U.S. election are on the defensive. So what's your sense of where that clarity will emerge, when that clarity will emerge?
I think that it's going to be a while before we have complete clarity. But I do think the idea that there are people in Russia who are feeling buyer's remorse is probably correct. The reason I say that is the effect of all of the publicity about connections to Russia and help from Russia in getting Trump elected have forced Trump politically to act actually in a way that is against some of the Russian interests. So many of Putin's friends in Russia probably think, hey, this is unattractive blowback and we shouldn't have done it. It was fun to play when we didn't think he would win the election. But by God, once we started to play seriously, we bought ourselves a package that can't deliver for us and, by the way, is going to get us into trouble. Now, where we go from here is a very tough call. People have talked about impeachment. My analysis of things is if there's going to be anything like impeachment, it's going to come from the conflict of interest and the emoluments provisions of the Constitution. I think it's going to be very hard to go after Trump in an impeachment proceeding for things before he was elected president, because impeachment refers to the person in office and acts while in office. And the problem of could he be indicted by the Justice Department? Well, that raises all kinds of problems, especially since a sitting president cannot be brought to trial before his term is over. He can, of course, be tried as a civilian once he's out of office. But this is all a very long-term proposition. The Congress will take quite a bit of time to digest the findings, and it will be very hard for them to take a decision that's as politically fraught as impeachment would be. So I don't look for a quick resolution, but I'd say to people who think that nothing happened, that they must be smoking something, because there is so much that has come out in newspaper stories, in statements by public officials and former public officials. There's no question of the interference in the election and some level of collusion between Trump campaign people and the Russians. Mm-hmm. The question really is how much of this is a crime and what will the result of the investigation be?
And of course, it crosses some of the party lines, because Paul Manafort, as much as he's in the crosshairs of Robert Mueller, his partner in helping Yanukovych with money from Putin, Tad Devine, was the campaign chairman for Bernie Sanders. So it's not entirely just the Trump people and Republicans.
No, it's not. And I think what a lot of people in or outside of Washington don't understand is how many law firms and PR firms there are that are perfectly willing to take on the most noxious client, regardless of political affiliation of the people in the law firm or the PR firm, because there's good money in it.
Sure.
And welcome
to
a place where that's happened.
I was going to say, welcome to Nigeria on the Potomac. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Jack Blum, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who's an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and serves as the chair of the expert group on international asset recovery, and currently serves as the chair of the Tax Justice Network and the Violence Policy Center. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining Trump's recent about-face in the Oval Office and the Chuck and Nancy romance that might save the DACA program. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sarah Binder, who's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a professor of political science at George Washington University, where she specializes in Congress and legislative politics. She's an associate editor of the Washington Post Monkey Cage blog and co-author of Advice and Dissent, The Struggle to Shape the Federal Judiciary, and the author of Stalemate, Causes and Consequences of Legislative Gridlock. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Binder.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Sarah. And What do you make of Donald Trump's recent about-face in the Oval Office? Because it seems to me that there's a possibility that the Democrats have been crowing, particularly on MSNBC, about how Chuck and Nancy basically smoked Paul Ryan and McConnell. But is it also possible that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell were secretly relieved that they didn't have to face a showdown with their rebellious Tea Party caucuses threatening to shut down the government over the debt ceiling?
Well, I think you put your finger on precisely everything that's been going on here in Washington, right? And the issue was really twofold, if not threefold. First, this is a really unpredictable president, and he is unmoored, right? He's unattached to any ideology or even any particular policy prescriptions generally. He wants to win. He wants to make deals. And the second factor he eventually seems to have figured out is this is a very divided Republican Party in Washington. You could call it a civil war going on inside the party. You could call it a deep ideological cleavage in that party. But they, Ryan, the House Speaker, and McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, they don't command a majority. They don't have a procedural majority to proceed on the big issues of the day, on the Republican agenda. And that has left an opening for the Democrats, who do have an agenda on which they are united, in part because they're in the minority, they're out of power. And Trump walked right into I don't want to call it a trap, but he walked right into an opening or a plan that the two Democratic leaders laid for him, which is to sort of grab him in on a popular issue here, in particular on the fate of DACA recipients.
So in terms of the Chuck and Nancy romance, it does seem that it was unfortunate that Chuck was caught on a hot mic talking about how much Trump really likes him, which I'm not sure plays well with the Democratic base. But on the other hand, even talk of any kind of DACA deal is driving Trump's base crazy. So how is he going to navigate that? Because it's, you know, he's sent so many mixed signals and mixed statements and tweets about whether or not his wall will be built or be part of a deal to save the Dreamers.
Well, for sure. I think it would be premature to say that it's a done deal that DACA recipients will be protected, let alone what a DACA bill would look like. Certainly there's politics here on both sides of the aisle, right? For the Republicans, as you mentioned, right, this immigration really, it's not on an issue on congressional Republicans' agenda, right? Neither really was, you know, health care. These aren't the issues they want to be legislating on, right? And by virtue of reaching across to Chuck and Nancy, Trump is driving this wedge, right, within the Republican Party. Those who are hardcore on the wall, hardcore on deporting undocumented people who are here, hardcore in deporting DACA, versus call them centrist, maybe moderate, I'm not so sure, but other parts and more establishment parts of the Republicans who see an economic reason for, at least for protecting DACA and others. But of course, right, the proof is in the pudding here, where Republicans come down and whether Trump is going to actually enunciate a policy where he takes a stand, right? Is it going to be path to citizenship? Is it just extending these temporary work permits for DACA? Is it border security? What does that look like? I think Republicans, as you said, look, Ryan and McConnell almost grateful that, you know, their responsibility here is little diminished here. I think they're going to lay it on the White House. Take a stand, produce a package, and you build majorities. So it's unclear to me precisely how Republicans are going to maneuver their way, but some of it will depend on Trump, right, taking a position and sticking to it, which, of course, he didn't do on health care. And that's part of why that civil war and the Republicans over repeal and replace kind of devoured their policy.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Binder, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a professor of political science at George Washington University, where she specializes in Congress and legislative politics. She's an associate editor of the Washington Post's Monkey Cage blog and co-author of Advice and Dissent, The Struggle to Shape the Federal Judiciary, and the author of Stalemate, Causes and Consequences of Legislative Gridlock. But how do you explain, though, why Trump consistently panders to a shrinking minority, roughly around 35%. And of course, this minority is now going to be riled up even more by Stephen Bannon, who, along with a billionaire backer, Robert Mercer, who was the largest donor to the Trump campaign, they apparently are going to start funding Tea Party candidates for the Senate and House to run against Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell's anointed or incumbent candidates?
Well, you know, you and I look at opinion polls. We see surveys. We see the public approval rating. Generally, we see that 35%, right, that the president's base, real hardcore base, seems to be a small sliver of the public, but I would probably say a sizable majority of the Republicans. So you and I see a minority of the population, but I don't think Trump sees it that way. He seems to think his election is owed to rallying those that hardcore base, and he seems to draw like some sort of energy or sustenance from appealing to that group. Of course, you know, going backing track on the wall could put that at jeopardy, which is probably why you see him backtracking a little bit this week. No deal, right? We didn't shake a deal. We're still going to do the wall, right? He seems to be wanting to have it both ways.
But he seems to be predisposed to the furthest right-wing conspiratorial thinking from the Alex Jones world, from Breitbart, who really are about provocation as opposed to illumination. Or any kind of policies. It's just the bomb-throwing wing. And it seems like for the longest time they've been able to slip stuff to him that's, you know, on the along the lines of the kind of Russian misinformation that we're finding out is on Facebook. And apparently the bodyguard's left now, so at least General Kelly is able to put in front of Trump what's actually happening in the real world, whether or not he takes the presidential daily briefings or not, we still don't know. But it's an amazing situation, isn't it, to have a president who really, traffics in alternative facts.
Well, for sure. And I think part of the disconnect here between those of us who study politics and those of us who read papers and study history and politics is that we're used to politicians coming having some sort of ideological mooring, right? Whether it's on the far left or the far right or centrist, we expect them to maintain a sort of consistency of positions. But I don't think that's the worldview of Donald Trump. I don't think he sees that there's a cost to his public reputation for siding with the hardcore populist right. I don't think he sees politics in that sort of left-right map. And if you're not committed to a particular policy position, and you're not committed to a certain ideological what issues go with which, it seems Trump thinks he can reach across the aisle, and, right? And from his worldview, there's Chuck and Nancy ready to make a deal. I think he sees the world as deal making, and he sees it about how does he come out ahead? That's not really what we're used to seeing in the White House, and it allows him, or it seems to empower him, to be all over the map, right? And seemingly not pay a cost on many issues for some really out of the mainstream views, right? Certainly in the views expressed after Charlottesville.
But prior to that, the people that were hired in his cabinet and in the key positions inside the government pretty much fit the pattern of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank. And there's inescapable hostility to government itself with people like Scott Pruitt and others. So what explains that? Here you have a president who's now figuring out, I got to find a way to make government work, when he's hired a whole bunch of people dedicated to, as Stephen Bannon said, deconstructing the administrative state.
Well, then the question is, how much does Trump know what's going on within these bureaucracies that to whom he's right appointed these leaders? I think he sees this cabinet in terms of loyalty to him. I mean, you and I can map all these, Rick Pruitt, DeVos. We can map all these heads of the departments in sort of the sort of hardcore Republican, right? They sort of fit this conservative Republican ideology. But I don't know that that's how Trump thinks about what they're doing. And to the extent that they fit a sort of deregulation, a tearing down EPA, sort of removing what was Obama had put into place, I think that's how Trump sees the world. Now, the question I think comes for the Democrats. And pressures from the base on Schumer and Pelosi, what type of deals are you making? And are you really, by virtue of shaking hands, say, on DACA, or are you putting sort of normalizing what's going on within the bureaucracy? And those are the pressures on the left, which have not really come to the fore yet, but I think we'll continue to see if this type of reaching across the aisle continues from Trump out of the White House.
Well, exactly. I think a lot of Democrats were unsettled by Chuck Schumer's, you know, schoolgirl giddiness that Trump likes him. Not exactly what they want to hear, I don't think.
I assume Schumer and Pelosi will make this argument as the time comes, which is to say, look, we are out of power. And yet we have got the White House moving on our issues, right? And certainly, right, a longstanding priority of the Democrats has been immigration reform and a path to citizenship for those who are here undocumented. Mm-hmm. And to think that in unified Republican control, that it looks like there could be a deal that addresses a hardcore Democratic interest, I fully expect Schumer and Pelosi to start articulating that argument. Right, which is really almost unheard for in the last sort of post-war period when we've had unified party control.
So do you think that the Democrats have figured out something which seems pretty apparent, that Donald Trump's previous employment as a reality TV star is really where he's at? Because he spends an inordinate amount of time watching television to see how his reality TV show, The American Presidency, is playing. It's almost like an actor who's more interested in the reviews than actually doing the performance. And one wonders exactly how much time he spends actually doing the job, or how engaged he is in doing the job. So do you think that is a key here, that this is a paradoxical man who has said some very hateful things, about Mexicans praised the Nazis in Charlottesville, but at the same time, he clearly wants to be loved.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think that was, and I think Nancy Pelosi and I think Chuck Schumer understand that about him and want to exploit it, right? Find issues on which there's strong public support, not necessarily within his base, but strong, broad public support, and even, say, from business interests, right? And the DACA issue really fits that, right? Where the headlines and the pictures after he announced that they were ending it or were going to end the DACA program, those are pretty, I think my hunch is he heard a lot from a lot of different quarters saying, what are you doing? And he seems to be motivated by those types of headlines. Now, I don't want to push that argument too far, right? The reaction to what he said in the wake of Charlottesville was really, really hard from all, right, corners, many corners of the Republican Party, and certainly from Democrats, and certainly from business interests, right? We saw everybody stepping down from those councils he had set up, and the councils were just there for optics, I think, in the first place, right? But the president has never really stepped back from what he said after Charlottesville, and so I think we'll be a little cautious here on how much he's motivated by the headlines. Mm-hmm. Right?
Well, he doubled down on Charlottesville just the other day. He went back.
Absolutely. And that does give one pause when we say that he doesn't seem to have something that he believes in, but he seems to be quite committed on this far-right sort of nationalism, sort of white nationalism. He's I don't know if he quite understands what he's saying, but that's certainly what's forecast from him. So we should be a little cautious on how much he's motivated. But certainly on these DACA issues, and perhaps we'll see this later, perhaps on something like infrastructure, he seems motivated by the headlines.
Well, just in closing, I watched Hillary Clinton speaking the other day on the Rachel Maddow program, and there's been some negative press about her, sort of whining about losing and not taking responsibility, etc. But frankly, that didn't seem to be the case in this interview. What came across to me is that how incredibly sad it is that a very qualified person is not the president of the United States, and an extremely unqualified person is. And so how do you see the Democrats going forward? Do you think the country in any way is recovering from its sort of spasm of the ecstasy of anger and now may want some competence? My fear is the Democrats are too invested in impeachment and not invested enough in coming up with a new narrative, candidates, and a vision going forward.
Well, I mean, I think most likely the two ways to think about it here, the public, large portions of the public do remain angry. And I think that's something that Hillary Clinton says, which is, look, I was giving them policy prescriptions and they wanted me to be angry. I think this, the future for the Democrats, I don't know that what we saw in that election between someone without governing or any governing experience and someone with, I think, very little conception of public service, right, beating from the Electoral College vote, someone who has spent her career in public service and in pursuit of policy goals. I don't know that that's the last time we'll see that type of election. Right, so long as there's dissatisfaction, and so long as there are candidates like Donald Trump who they stoked it, right? You have to if you give voters a choice like that, some of them, not a majority of voters, but a majority of the Electoral College took that choice. I don't know that that's something that goes away quite so quickly, and for the Democrats, of course. At least for those who plot elections, they know that 2018 is a referendum on Trump. It's not a do we like the Democrats or Republicans better. It's like what do you think of the Republicans governing? So until we get past 2018 and closer into past that election, Democrats are going to be kind of feeling their way around, seeing what's coming next.
Well, Sarah Bender, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Bender, who's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a professor of political science at George Washington University, where she specializes in Congress and legislative politics. She's an associate editor of the Washington Post Monkey Cage blog and co-author of Advice and Dissent, The Struggle to Shape the Federal Judiciary, and the author of Stalemate, Causes and Consequences of Legislative Gridlock. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into another outbreak of unrest in St. Louis following the acquittal of a white police officer who was charged with first-degree murder for shooting a black man following a high-speed chase. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Garrett Duncan, a professor of education in African and African American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. He has an article, How to Make Black Lives Matter, and joins us from St. Louis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Garrett Duncan.
Thank you for having me.
And why is it that St. Louis seems to be so riven with racial tensions, protests? I mean, the protests that took place over the weekend, this weekend and last night in St. Louis were not very far from where in Ferguson, Michael Brown was shot by police back in 2014. And it does feel like we keep repeating history there, if you will, which would indicate that things aren't getting better. So let's start with that premise. Are race relations better now than they were back in 2014 after the Michael Brown shooting?
Not at all. You indicated that I teach at Washington University in St. Louis. Among black folks in the community, we are nicknamed the Plantation. That is the nickname of the university. And part of it has to do with the racial strife that is a result of the sundown towns, where the community has been legally and extra-legally divided and along racial and economic lines. And part of what is going on to sustain those lines has been violence perpetrated against black communities in our metropolitan regions.
And when you say sundown towns, the sundown is a reference to that blacks can't be seen on the streets after sundown.
You better believe it. They have to get out of town. In fact, not only get out of town, they had to leave, or we've had to leave. Let me be clear. I'm black as well. We've had to leave the town before sundown, and we've also had to leave behind us our accessories, our businesses, our homes, and all of our assets, which were taken away from us, which if you come to St. Louis, race is almost conflated with class along those lines. And we see the shootings out here as maintaining that particular order.
So let's talk about the acquittal of the white police officer who prosecutors charged with first-degree murder. He was involved, I believe he and other police officers saw what they thought was a drug deal going down in a diner. They went to move on the fellow that was shot. He backed his car out, I believe, smashed into the police cars, and then a high-speed chase followed. And the evidence is on dash cam video, where during the chase, Officer Stockley, who was just acquitted, says that he was, quote, going to kill this expletive, don't
right.
you know it? And that became an important part of the trial. And then I believe there was some kind of collision, the airbag went off, and then you see the video of the shots being fired into the car. Well, actually, the shots were fired into the car when it sped off from the diner initially. But then later, at the termination of the high-speed chase, he shot five times, and then it appears that the officer is planting a gun on him. So what happened there? Why is what people saw not what the judge saw?
Well, the judge seemed – I read the entire transcript of the judge's ruling on the verdict, and what he said, he seemed to be very empathetic with the police officers. In fact, he spoke of the stress that they felt. I don't know that Officer Stockley addressed the stress that he felt. And with respect to his foul language about killing this man, the judge said his statement can be ambiguous depending on the context, and that's quote unquote. And it just so happens the particular restaurant is one that I frequented over the 21 years that I've lived here in St. Louis. And I will tell you, as someone who would look, who might look like Anthony Smith. I would go back and forth from my car with and without a bag from the church's chicken, because we have a number of homeless people in the area, and I would often be asked if I would provide money for them to get food. And over the years, it occurred to me that me providing them change may appear that I was engaged in a transaction. And so I would actually bring them into the restaurant, but I would go back and forth between my car and the restaurant and provide them food or pay for their food. And I would also say the presence of heroin in the vehicle doesn't make the person who I consider to be murdered to be a drug dealer. We have folks all across the nation with narcotics in their vehicle, and there was no evidence presented that there was actually a transaction. It was always framed as a suspicion.
And again, I'm speaking with Garrett Duncan, a professor of education and of African and African-American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. And he has an article, How to Make Black Lives Matter. So, but the issue often come up in these shootings that the victims are then, their records are brought forth, and quite often they're not, you know, sterling citizens, to say the least. But that's not the issue, is it? I mean, police are not supposed to be executioners, are they? Isn't that the whole point here, that we have a judicial system, and when the public feels that justice is not served, then you have these kind of outbreaks, is what you've just witnessed in St. Louis.
Absolutely. The police are here to our understanding to protect and to serve. And keep in mind that Shockley made, I think, on his part, a wise decision to have the trial put forth before a judge as opposed to a jury. Here in St. Louis, we are a very diverse community, and the way that things went about, his relationship or the police department's relationship with a judge, and I can't speak for the judge or the police department, but they're related in a way that they're part of the judicial system and the law system, and that was his best bet to get the ruling that he received.
So what is the mood then of the public there? Because in some of these demonstrations against the police, journalists were also pelted with water bottles, etc. So is there a perception amongst protesters that somehow that the journalists are in league with the police, or what's the reason for the hostility towards the press?
Well, it's not so much in league, but there is a particular narrative presented. In fact, that evening, the protests began in what we call the Central West End, which has been gentrified. And you have many folks who have lost their jobs, and we see that as being a part of a capitalist movement to further marginalize in the late 21st century or the mid-21st century more black and working class and poor communities. And many of my students at my elite university, Washington University in St. Louis, they were among the protesters. And these are students from various backgrounds, and many of my colleagues were also a part of the protest. So it's not so much as being in league with the police, but adopting a narrative that they don't reflect upon. But I see that changing in the immediate future. People in St. Louis, in the metropolitan region, we're tired of seeing people murdered. We're tired of the violence.
So, Garrett, is that to say that you and I won't be having another conversation? Because we spoke a lot at the time of the Michael Brown shooting by a white police officer, and some reforms were brought about as a result of that, particularly the report by the federal government. Now, of course, you have Jeff Sessions
right
in there in at the DOJ, who's I think got a pretty demonstrated record of not being sympathetic to civil rights, to say the least. So, do you think we'll be having another conversation at some point soon in the future about another incident, or is you know, enough already?
Ian, I wish I could say that we will not be having another conversation. But in this community, more than anything, I was in Los Angeles when the Rodney King trial verdict came out, and I always use the metaphor that we wax and wane. So there is that possibility, but I am also hopeful because my chancellor at the university took a stand, and he called and he spoke out in the same tenor that we're speaking out, that we find these things to be troubling, and we see more and more folks galvanizing. And one of the things that I'm hopeful is that the broader community is listening to Maya Angelou when she said, while I write about the Black experience, I speak to the human condition. And folks are seeing that this is not just restricted to our Black communities, our working class communities, that any of us are at risk for these possible results.
Well, but, you know, we're in an era, you know, with all this these demonstrations, for example, at Berkeley, which are entirely organized by the right to make themselves look victims and martyrs of free speech, when they just bring these provocateurs onto to campuses, and you know, they're always attacking the Black Lives Matter, and the president himself is making comparisons between the Nazis and Black Lives Matter and the Antifa,
right,
and throwing them all into one bag. So it does. It's a very difficult time for demonstrators to sort of rise above the political spin.
Right. And, you know, my concern, going back to your previous question and responding directly to what you just brought about, is that with respect to the media, much of the focus has been on the vitriolic rhetoric, and it's much more than language. You have lives being damaged. You're having people who are killed, and lives are being swept away. And so while there's a connection between language and the actual violence, the media doesn't necessarily make that relationship. And I'm concerned that when, for example, the president is called a white supremacist, he is also that critique is equated with folks calling other people the N-word, for example. And the fact of the matter, those people who have been designated the N-word have not gone about systematically hanging unmasked or killing people of color. And so there needs to be a troubling, of that discourse at the media level. And it's not just an intellectual pursuit, but it's actually being thoroughly engaged in seeing, you know, the descriptive as opposed to the prescriptive. And when I say that, it is what's actually happening, the lives lost, as opposed to what people are saying.
Well, Garrett Duncan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I appreciate you having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Garrett Duncan, a professor of education and of African and African American studies in arts and sciences at the University of Washington in St. Louis. And he has an article, How to Make Black Lives Matter. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Jose Benavides and Graham Fitzgibbon. And this program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Something to me, an angel song about the home of the brave and this land here under free. One time.